David A. Hughes. He is the author of COVID-19, Psychological Operations and the War for Technocracy, and Wall Street, the Nazis, and the Crimes of the Deep State. He received his undergraduate and master's degree from Oxford University and holds doctorates in German studies from Duke University and international relations from Oxford Brookes University. He'll be presenting Resisting the Global Technocratic Coup, Seeing the Bigger Picture. And here it is.
Well, hello, everybody. The title of my presentation is Resisting the Global Technocratic Coup, Seeing the Bigger Picture. And I want to begin by contextualizing developments since 2020. And this involves considering what the status quo was pre-2020. Now, I get into this in more detail in my book, COVID-19, Psychological Operations and the War for Technocracy. But in simple terms, for decades, populations have been kept in check through a combination of four factors. Neoliberal economics, the international monetary and financial system, the propaganda system, and the so-called war on terror security paradigm. All of these control mechanisms entered crisis in the years leading up to 2020. So if we begin by thinking about the first of those mechanisms, neoliberal economics, here is a chart from the World Inequality Report 2022. And what it shows is that between 1995 and 2021, 38% of global wealth growth accrued to the richest 1% of the population. And most of that to the richest 0.001%. At the other end of the spectrum, the poorest half of humanity captured only 2% of the growth. So we're looking here at a system which is generating historically unprecedented levels of wealth inequality and concentrating the wealth extremely at one end. Now, in 2019, there were major social protests in 35 different countries. So that's one in five countries around the world. So this is obviously a massive sign of social unrest and discontent. And it comes at the end of four decades of neoliberal economics, and of course, the decade of so-called austerity following the 2008 financial crisis. And so we're looking here at signs of what the retired professor of international political economy, Kees van der Pijl, calls, quote, a dangerously lopsided oligarchic capitalism in terminal decline. The second factor I mentioned was the international monetary and financial system. Now, in many ways, this had been on life support since 2008 through quantitative easing. But in 2019, BlackRock published an extraordinary document titled Dealing with the Next Downturn. And in this document, it states that conventional monetary and fiscal policies will not be enough to deal with the next economic downturn. So there was clearly a major shift about to take place. The governor of the Bank of England at the time, Mark Carney, he told a group of very powerful figures in international finance at Jackson Hole, Wyoming in August 2019, that the center of the international monetary and financial system, quote, won't hold. The third factor that I mentioned was the propaganda system. Now, particularly in the West, the propaganda system has been essential to the manufacturing of consent in liberal democracies for at least a century. Indeed, the very term manufacturing of consent goes back to Walter Lippmann in the 1920s. In the 21st century, however, the propaganda system has been undermined by the rise of independent media and citizen journalism during a period of relative internet freedom prior to 2020. As a result of this freer exchange of information, more and more people came to see through the big lies that have been told. For example, around 9/11. It's evidently not the case that 19 Muslim hijackers, armed only with box cutters, were able to make two 110 steel-framed skyscrapers froth up into powder in the way shown here on the right. We also saw the introduction of the so-called Russian disinformation narrative in 2016. This is essentially a pretext for censorship, and it's a symptom that narrative control is starting to slip away. The final factor that I mentioned was the so-called war on terror. Now, of course, this was used to legitimize aggressive military measures abroad, but it also served as the pretext for repressive emergency measures at home. The basic idea is that the citizenry cedes its liberties and does as it's told in exchange for security. In other words, the more terror there is, the greater the capacity for social control. However, there was a proliferation of terror attacks between 2015 and 2017, particularly in France. But instead of encouraging more centralized control and a more passive and obedient citizenry, what we saw instead transnationally was protests assuming a more socially progressive form. For instance, not easily assimilable into populism. And this, of course, culminated in the worldwide protests of 2019. And so at every level, we are seeing the existing control system going into crisis. And therefore, in 2020, as the Italian philosopher Giorgio Agamben realized, it was evidently time for a paradigm shift. The so-called pandemic, real or fake, Agamben argued, was used as the pretext for beginning the transformation of existing governance paradigms, quote, top to bottom, end quote. Now, the World Economic Forum's Great Reset is code for a top-down revolution on a global scale. The aim is to remake all of society in the preferred image of the ruling class. And when you look at this diagram of the Great Reset by the World Economic Forum, you see how it touches every area of life. This is a total transformation of human existence. The new control paradigm that is to be introduced, if the powers that be have their way, is technocracy. And Patrick is going to speak in more detail about technocracy in his presentation. But for now, just let me make a few points about how it applies to the present. The idea of technocracy actually dates back to the 1930s. However, the technologies required to make it feasible and implementable are only now coming into existence. Primarily, they go under the name of smart technologies. Under technocracy, capitalism will be replaced by a centrally managed economy in which everything and everyone is digitally monitored and controlled. An all-digital financial system will give central banks direct control over the means of exchange, central bank digital currencies being the clear example here. Democracy will be replaced by the AI-enabled scientific management of society. One way of thinking about this is the Chinese-style social credit scoring system. And so all in all, what we're looking at here is a novel biodigital form of totalitarianism in the making. A classic image of technocracy is the smart city. And British Prime Minister Boris Johnson warned of this in his address to the UN General Assembly in 2019, when he referred to, quote, smart cities pullulating with sensors, all joined together by the Internet of Things, bollards communicating invisibly with lampposts. But, he warned, this technology could also be used to keep every citizen under round-the-clock surveillance. Digital authoritarianism is not, alas, the stuff of dystopian fantasy, but of an emerging reality. They always tell us. Catherine Austin Fitz, Aman Jabi, and I have all argued in our different ways that what we are looking at here, in fact, extends beyond cities, that in fact we are looking at the transformation of the whole of society into what Fitz calls a digital concentration camp. The next section of my presentation is titled World War III, Omniwar. Now, as I argue in my book, historically, socio-political and economic change on the scale of the Great Reset has only been possible through world war. It follows that global technocracy can only be instituted through world war. And so therefore, I argue in the book that we now find ourselves in World War III and have done since the WHO pandemic declaration of 2020, and that this war assumes the form of a global class war. You can download the book for free from my Substack, dhughes@substack.com. Now, World War III looks nothing like World War I or World War II, just as they did not resemble anything that had been seen before. The aims, the strategies, the tactics, and the weapons are all different. Technology typically revolutionizes war. And if we look at contemporary technologies, for example, in this advanced science front cover from November 2020, just before the vaccine rollout began, we see a nanobot swimming through a bloodstream controlled by EMF frequencies. You see the mast in the background there. But what we do know is that the outcomes of World War III, in terms of the lives lost and the manifestation of previously unimaginable horrors, will be the same unless those behind the war can be stopped. Now, I've coined the term omni-war to describe World War III. And by this, I mean a war that is waged across every domain of life, but clandestinely, so that the public does not recognize it as such. Omni-war is war waged by the few against the many. A proportionately minuscule transnational ruling class seeks to use its control over the means of production to subjugate and ultimately enslave the rest of humanity. Another way of thinking about the Omni-war is as a global counterinsurgency campaign, with dissidents set to replace terrorists as the enemy in the infrastructure established through the so-called War on Terror. James Corbett offers a fitting description of the Omni-war when he refers to, quote, an all-out war that is being waged against all of us right now, and it is a battle for full spectrum dominance over every single aspect of your life. Your movements and interactions, your transactions, even your innermost thoughts and feelings and desires. Governments the world over are working with corporations to leverage technology to control you down to the genomic level, and they will not stop until each and every person who resists them is subdued or eliminated. End quote. In this context, Elsa van Hamelen asks a pertinent question. How is it possible that for some, it is very clear that we are facing a coup, revolution, or even Third World War, while for others, everything is seemingly normal? The answer, I would propose, is that the Omni-war is a stealth war. It is designed to stay hidden, lest the population realise what is happening. Because if it does, there is real jeopardy for those waging this war. There is real risk of mass resistance and potentially even revolution. Nothing like the Omni-war has ever been seen before. There is no historical precedent to which we can compare it. As I will show shortly, cognition and rationality are themselves under attack as part of the Omniwar, making it difficult for the public to see clearly what is happening. And this problem is compounded by the military-grade perception management techniques that are being deployed against it. Many of the weapons in the Omniwar are invisible, and some may even involve classified technologies. And finally, the sheer scale and the sheer evil of this assault is shocking, it's traumatic, and it's difficult to comprehend and accept. Now, as its name indicates, the Omniwar entails the weaponization of everything. For example, we are seeing a multifaceted attack on the mind and the brain. My book on COVID is just volume one of two. It's 400 pages long, and it's all about the psychological warfare operation that was waged against the public in 2020, 2021. On top of that, we might layer on NATO's cognitive warfare doctrine, which is described as, quote, the art of using technology to alter the cognition of human targets who are often unaware of any such attempt. So the use of social media, for example, to harvest data on users and to create psychographic profiles, which are then used to manipulate perception, is the classic example. Electromagnetic warfare dates at least as far back as the Soviet attack on the US embassy in Moscow in the 1950s. We can trace it more recently through so-called Havana syndrome since 2016. And as I've argued in these two pieces, it seems evident to me that such techniques are being used against innocent civilians in an experimental capacity today. Direct neurological warfare is also entering the frame. I'll talk more about that later, but you get a picture of the way it's being conceptualized when you look at the joystick directly controlling the brain in the image in the bottom right. Healthcare has been weaponized since 2020, at least. Deprivation of necessary healthcare in the name of reconfiguring health services to deal with COVID-19 resulted in what I have called public health as death by stealth. For example, if we look at this data relating to the NHS, we see that in England, the NHS waiting list has more or less doubled since 2020. Before 2020, it was almost unheard of to go to accident and emergency and have a 12-hour wait. These days, it's the norm. So what we're looking at here is the recipe for a sicker population. Vaccines, even before 2020, were known to contain an array of heavy metals. What's really disturbing is the imagery that's emerged from microscopists in the COVID-19 vaccine context. It's unclear what all of this stuff is in the top right of the picture, but it evidently shouldn't be there. We've seen declines in birth rates since the so-called COVID-19 vaccine rollout. For example, in the central image on the right, each different color represents a year. So we have 2020 in green, 2021 in blue, which of course was the year of the rollout, and then in red, a significant fall in birth rates. That's from Switzerland, but this is a transnational phenomenon. We've also seen massive increases in the reported serious adverse reactions following the rollout. At the bottom here, we see OpenVEA's data relating to reports of deaths. Over many, many decades, the peak number of reports was 603 in 2019. But then 2 years later, it spikes to 22,264 reports, which is 37 times higher. We're also dealing with what the Soleri report refers to as the great poisoning. For example, glyphosate, which the WHO recognizes is probably carcinogenic, was found in 80% of US urine samples in a recent study. So-called forever chemicals contaminating rainwater, surface water, and ground soil are a real problem. And look what's in the food supply. High fructose corn syrup, known to be harmful and often associated with the rise in obesity levels. Sweeteners such as aspartame, which the WHO recognises is possibly carcinogenic, and other nano-sized inorganic contaminants in food in addition. And then we have the water supply. Fluoride in drinking water can cause major adverse human health problems, according to a 2014 study. Even the Department of Health and Human Services in August this year recognised that over 1.5 milligrams per litre of fluoride is associated with lower IQ in children. Water could also be used to engineer artificial water shortages, and that's something that I've got into in a recent Substack article. We're also looking at financial warfare. For example, punishing levels of inflation driven by the unprecedented increase in the money supply in 2020. In the BlackRock report that I mentioned earlier, it's quite open about the fact that increasing the money supply will drive inflation. Then in 2019, just look at the very steep increase here. This is Federal Reserve data, particularly the red line. And then the kind of yellowy-greeny line is inflation as measured by commodity prices. And so a couple of years later, that follows. We're also seeing higher energy costs due to manufactured energy shortages, for example, the destruction of the Nord Stream pipeline and the war in Ukraine. And we're also seeing financial censorship of dissidents, the best example perhaps being the Freedom Convoy in Canada, where supporters of the convoy had their bank accounts frozen. Information warfare has reared its ugly head since 2020. We've seen plenty of censorship, shadow banning, the Linda Yaccarina principle of freedom of speech but not reach, self-appointed fact checkers, networks such as the Trusted News Initiative, the counter disinformation industry, all of this being rolled out under the pretext of combating so-called mis, dis and mal information, with governments positioning themselves as what the former New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern called the single source of truth. Law and order also being weaponized, it seems. Think back to the transnational police brutality that was used to intimidate dissidents during the COVID era. In my book, Wall Street, the Nazis and the Crimes of the Deep State, I discuss the draconian legislation that is now being used in the UK to expand police powers, to clamp down on protests, to place limits on journalism, and to allow governments to regulate the internet. Lawfare is also being used to intimidate dissidents. The Richard D. Hall case in this country, which awaits its verdict next month, being the prime example. Migration has also displayed some extraordinary patterns since the Omni War began. We're seeing historically unprecedented levels of migration from non-Western countries into the West. This is Office for National Statistics data here in the UK. The vertical black line shows when the end of the EU transition period occurred. What you notice, however, is that the non-EU immigration, which is the dark blue line, having previously remained in a relatively tight range up until this point, suddenly spikes well out of it. So, of course, this can be expected to have a socially destabilizing effect. We don't know for sure exactly who all of these people are that are coming in, but this is not just the UK. This is a transnational phenomenon. Religion is under attack, in particular Christianity in the West. We saw this, for example, with the complicity of the churches with the so-called COVID-19 agenda, with the Archbishop of Canterbury, for instance, saying that Jesus would get a vaccine, or the churches closing their doors to the sick and the lepers, but nevertheless turning their facilities into vaccination centres a year later. Satanic messaging is laced into popular culture and has been for some time. The Vigilant Citizen website is very good at tracing this. One notable recent example was the opening ceremony of the Paris Olympic Games with the mockery of the Last Supper shown on the screen here. On top of that, we have transhumanist fantasies of what Yuval Noah Harari calls going beyond the God of the Bible. Then we have the entertainment industry. Hollywood represents what Secker and Alford call a vast militarized propaganda apparatus operating throughout the screen entertainment industry in the United States. And similarly, the music industry, as Mark Devlin has exposed in his Musical Truth trilogy, it turns out that most household names have military connections. Perhaps most sickeningly, we are witnessing the war on children. COVID restrictions on face-to-face education had what the Cabinet Office recognises were, quote, significant and adverse impacts on children's learning, end quote. Children were traumatised by being treated as biohazards capable of killing granny and being forced to wear masks. The lockdowns led to increased levels of domestic violence and PTSD. Children were unnecessarily targeted for dangerous experimental injections, as I have argued. And on top of all of this, there is more and more evidence that a worldwide paedophile network reaches into the highest levels of power. Now, I could go on. There's so much more to say. I could talk about the war on the elderly. I could talk about the tyranny of woke ideology. I could talk about the failure of captured regulators to protect the public. The logic of the Omniwar is that everything that can be weaponized will be weaponized. That said, in the remainder of this presentation, I want to focus on just a few aspects of the Omniwar that I think warrant special attention. Beginning with the concept of network-centric warfare. This goes back to the late 1990s, and the Marine Corps War College report said that network-centric warfare, quote, places information networks at the center of our war fighting. A few years later, the Global Information Grid was developed and is operated by the US Strategic Command. This essentially provides the technical infrastructure for network-centric warfare. You could think of it as a system of systems, integrating sensor systems, command and control centers, and weapons platforms. According to one 2014 study, the DoD seeks to, quote, plug every device into it, every vehicle, every system, every drone, to form one all-encompassing net. So, of course, drone warfare is a classic instance of this. It relies on information superiority to identify, locate, and assassinate targets, supposedly with high precision and minimal collateral damage, although, as we know, disproportionately high civilian casualty rates have occurred, and we also know about the deliberate tactic of double tapping. Now, in recent years, network-centric warfare has become linked to AI. This goes back to 2012, when there was a significant advance in AI, and immediately this was weaponized in DoD Directive 3000.09, titled Autonomy in Weapons Systems. And we see it in action in Project Maven, which has been in development since 2017. The Maven smart system is operated by Palantir. It integrates geospatial imagery from satellites, geolocation data from smartphones and social media and so on, signals intelligence, radar, and infrared sensors, all to provide real-time battlefield analysis and target identification. And it's already been used in practice, for example, this year, to identify targets for airstrikes in Syria and Yemen. The IDF has also deployed AI in Gaza, for instance, to single out 37,000 Palestinians as suspected militants at the start of that war. Google also has a hand in this. It has a $1.2 billion deal with the IDF to provide cloud computing services and AI capabilities. Now, the most disturbing aspect to me of all of this is the possibility that the kill decision could be automated. For example, if we think about Israeli weapons systems company Elbit Systems, on its website, it talks about its Lanius loitering munition. Lanius, it says, can autonomously take off, navigate, determine entry points to buildings, map the inside of unknown buildings, identify combatants and non-combatants among the building occupants, and detonate explosive payloads, albeit with a man-in-the-loop control in the final stage. Now, it doesn't require much imagination to remove that man-in-the-loop control, and then you have a fully automated killing system from start to finish. Now, what if human beings and human bodies become nodes on a biodigital control network? What if human brains and bodies could be hooked up to the global information grid? What if companies such as Palantir could manage all of the resultant data? The answer is that global technocracy would be achieved. Everything and everyone could be monitored and controlled. So this brings us to the concept of biodigital convergence, which essentially is about connecting human brains and bodies to an external control network. It's related to what is called the nano-bio-info-cogno era, or NBIC for short, which goes back to the early 2000s in planning documents by NASA, the National Science Foundation, the RAND Corporation, and many other non-healthcare related entities that I discuss in my book. Now, at that time, it was just a vision, but in more recent times, it started to look like more of a reality, particularly via the so-called Internet of Bio-Nano Things, which in a seminal paper from 2015, co-authored, but the lead author was Professor Ian F. Akiyildiz. This to me looks a lot like biodigital convergence in practice. So that paper discussed bio-cyber interfaces, which would, quote, translate information from the biochemical domain of bio-nano-thing networks inside the body to the internet cyber domain and vice versa, end quote. Now, that might be a bit of a mouthful, but you get the idea just by looking at this diagram here. Essentially, it's about creating intracorporeal nano-networks that are capable of communicating with the internet. This is typically marketed under a healthcare pretext, but of course the biodigital convergence literature goes back way, way before this. So are we really looking at health here, or are we looking at national security? Last year, Akiyildiz gave a presentation to NATO in which he revealed that his research since the 1990s has been conducted in conjunction with NASA, the US Army, the National Science Foundation, the CIA, DARPA, and the US Air Force. So I'd say we're looking very much at national security as opposed to health. Targeting the brain. James Giordano is a neuroscience advisor to the Pentagon. And he has referred to the brain as what he calls the 21st century battlescape. In an address to the cadets at West Point in 2017, Giordano stated that weaponized neurotechnology can be used to, quote, one, assess, predict, and control particular cognitions, emotions, and behaviors. Two, mitigate aggression and foster cognitions, emotions, and or behaviors of affiliation or passivity. 3, incur burdens of morbidity, disability, or suffering, and in this way, quote, neutralize potential opponents, or 4, induce mortality, end quote. So in simpler terms, weaponized neurotechnology can be used to control subjective experience and behaviors, or leave a target sick, disabled, or dead. Now, the way it works, Giordano went on to explain the following year, is, and I quote, to put minimal size electrodes in a network within a brain through only minimal intervention to be able to read and write into the brain function in real time remotely, end quote. Now, by this time, Charles Lieber and his team of scientists had successfully injected neural nets directly into the brains of rats, and they seamlessly integrated with the neural tissue. So this was already known to be possible. However, there's actually no need to inject directly into the brain, because new nanomaterials, such as graphene, can cross the blood-brain barrier following peripheral injection. Indeed, one study from 2020 refers to this as, quote, a simple technique. Then, in 2019, DARPA contracted the tech development company Battelle for its next generation non-surgical neurotechnology program. This boasts that bidirectional brain control technology interfaces can be introduced into the body, and I quote here, via injection and directed to a specific area of the brain via magnetoelectric signals. So 2019, and we have DARPA looking at using syringe injectable neurotech on humans. And then the following year, the universal vaccination campaign begins. Normalcy only returns, Gates said, when we've largely vaccinated the entire global population. And if newspaper reports are to be believed, which they generally are not, but 5.55 billion people had reportedly been injected by March 2023. So Lissa, in her presentation, is going to say a little more about the timing of all of this. A report last year by NATO's Joint Warfare Center rather spilled the beans. Here are a couple of quotes from it. The human mind is becoming the battlefield of tomorrow. And this means that every person is a potential target. Warfare is no longer a purely military concept. It has become much broader and more complex. In the future, there will be only one rule in warfare. Namely, there are no rules. So how else are we to read this, if not as a declaration of lawless, unrestricted warfare against the population? Here's another quote. Neural nanotechnology can be used to bring nano-sized robots close to a neuron. Sorry, the text is a little small on my screen. And make it possible to link the human brain directly to a computer, making use of artificial intelligence in the process. So here's NATO openly talking in the present about neural nanotechnology being used to link the brain to a computer involving AI. Now, injections are not the only means of delivering this kind of technology. SmartDust offers another possibility. So what is this? Let's go back to Giordano. Quote, a nano swarm of biopenetrable materials that you cannot see, that can penetrate all but the most robust biochemical filters, that are able to integrate themselves through a variety of membranes, mucous membranes, and wherever, mouth, nose, ears, eyes, eventually diffusing directly into the brain space. And these can be weaponized, such that their presence is almost impossible to detect, and as such, the attribution becomes exceedingly difficult to demonstrate. Particles so small that they can enter the human body, you can't stop them coming in. They can make their way to the brain and they can be weaponized. In an article that was scrubbed from the internet from 2017, but can still be found on the Wayback Machine, Alexander Light makes some interesting points. One of them is that injections, GMO mosquitoes, bioengineered food, and stratospheric aerosol injection, colloquially referred to as chemtrails, are all potential mechanisms for delivering smart dust or sensors into human bodies, promising what he called a synthetic network on the inside, which can be remotely controlled from the outside. And so in that context, we do have to ask serious questions about the intense crisscross patterns that have appeared in the sky. Our skies never used to look like this. So is so-called stratospheric aerosol injection, supposedly plans to dim the sun in future, is that narrative a cover potentially for smart dust already being sprayed on populations? I don't know, but we have to ask the question. And then there's bioengineered food. I recommend this report by Elsa van Hamelen on pharma food. One of the many excellent points she makes is that food which is increasingly produced by the pharmaceutical industry could potentially offer a delivery mechanism for biotech. In that context, we have to think about the World Economic Forum's agendas to do with synthetic meat and eating insects. Why do they want us to be eating synthetic meat? We also have to take into account the war on farmers, which has been taking place transnationally, driving farmers off their land, as well as attacks on food manufacturing plants. And meanwhile, two well-known eugenicists, Bill Gates and Ted Turner, have recently become the largest owners of US farmland. So they're clearly looking to control the food supply. To what end? Final part of my presentation, just a few slides on remote control networks. So if they are able to get this kind of bio-nanotechnology into human bodies, what kind of remote control mechanisms might be possible? Well, there are legitimate concerns about 5G beamforming technology. It's important to understand that 5G is qualitatively different from the previous generations of cell phone technology, because it's capable of targeting individual devices in the manner shown on this diagram. So, when Duke University professor Nita Farhani advocated at the World Economic Forum for what she called a massive shift from wearables to implanted brain technology, she evidently had no conception that in a military context, this would allow human brains to be targeted as precisely as individual smartphones by 5G. And more disturbingly still, will there be any escape from these wireless control networks? When we think about Elon Musk's Starlink project, or Amazon's project Kuiper, or OneWeb, Earth Now, these are all vying to provide internet coverage to all parts of the world from low Earth orbit. We also have companies such as Stratospheric Platforms beaming 5G from drones and airplanes. So it seems evident that the aim is to make 5G and subsequently 6G, 7G and so on, make these networks ubiquitous. In conclusion, first, let me summarize the argument. One, the existing control system went into crisis in 2019, which is why the war for technocracy began in 2020. Two, that war assumes the form of an omni-war, waged clandestinely against the population across all areas of life. Three, everything that can be weaponized against the public is being weaponized. 4. Network-centric warfare leverages information networks and is increasingly powered by AI. 5. Plans to connect human bodies to the control grid, dating back to the early 2000s, are coming to fruition via the Internet of Bio-Nano Things. And 6. The brain is now targetable via syringe-injectable neurotechnologies and smart dust. At the same time, wireless networks are becoming inescapable. What are the implications of all of this? Well, like it or not, we are all combatants now in World War III. The aggressors in that war are fighting for global technocracy, which is a totalitarian control system premised on biodigital technologies. If they are successful, the result will be a novel and potentially irreversible slavery system, whereby technocrats will have total control over your life. Plans to engineer human bodies to render them compatible with a ubiquitous wireless control network are decades in the making. And so if human brains and bodies become nodes on a biodigital control grid, remote control torture and assassination cannot be ruled out, and nor can automated decisions, including the kill decision, taken by AI. So what are we to do about this? Well, first of all, we have to understand what it is that we're facing. And I've sought to lay that out as clearly as I can in this presentation. Armed with that knowledge, each of us as a participant in the Omniwar has an obligation to act. Different people bring different talents to bear, but collective action is key here. We have to work together. Defeatism is unacceptable. Resistance is needed to all aspects of the Omniwar. Find where you can make a difference. We have the numbers on our side, and therefore spreading awareness and understanding is crucial. Finally, the enemy is reliant on biodigital technologies, and so strategically, that is where our attention should be focused. Just some further information to finish with. Every year and every image in this presentation is hyperlinked to the original source. So if you wish to access the presentation materials, please visit technocracy.news/omniwar. You may wish to follow my work at my Substack, dhughes.substack.com. And if you wish to support my work, davidahughes.net/support or buymeacoffee.com/dahughes. Thank you for listening.